We're now back in session. And we have agenda item 9, workshop on resolution number R1-215-001, draft policy in support of restoration projects in the North Coast region and basin plan amendment, Jonathan Warmerdam.
Good afternoon. Is this mic on? Is everybody here? I think we're yes. Good afternoon, Chairman Corbett, members of the board. My name is Jonathan Warmerdam. I'm an environmental scientist on your staff. Glad to be here on this somewhat rainy, drizzly day for a change. Today I'll be going over a draft policy in support of restoration in the North Coast region. Before we start, I'd like to acknowledge a couple people in the past that have worked on this. This has been an effort that's been ongoing for a number of years. Including Holly Lundborg and Lauren Clyde and Alita Mangelsdorf. They all contributed at one point to different versions of this. Most recent version I've been involved with for about the last year, as well as Samantha Olson. So it's been a group effort, and I want to acknowledge those people too. As we start, I'd like to just recite this first statement that's in the Federal Clean Water Act. The objective of this act is to restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. Seemed very fitting for the purpose of this policy, and that's why we also included it as the very first statement in the policy itself. Maybe we could get those lights back there.
There's a slider.
There we go. Don't want anybody to fall asleep. And so I also wanted to bring up our current vision statement that this office has been working with. We recently came to this. It's healthy watersheds, effective regulation, and strong partnerships. As some of you are all aware, I'm sure we've been going through a visioning process for the last 2 years, essentially, going through and identifying some of our different priorities that we see us working on over the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and prioritizing those and trying to find out ways to implement those. And restoration was one of those different elements highlighted as a priority for us. And so this policy is in many ways a manifestation of that exercise of us doing our visioning through this process. So there's six different components to the restoration policy that I'll go over in this presentation. Primarily, it's that restoration is an important recovery tool. We want to really highlight that. It's an important part of what we are doing, what we would like to emphasize. Working on further in the future. There are obstacles to restoration that we recognize. Some of them we have control over, some of them we don't. We'll go over those a little briefly. The policy recites existing laws and regulations that we must consider when we're issuing permits for restoration. I'll go over some of the Regional Water Board's ongoing efforts to support restoration projects, and then there's a declaration from the regional board towards staff as far as some of the actions that we'd like to continue to move forward with in the future. And finally, there is a proposal for a basin plan amendment narrative to be included in the basin plan, which is fairly silent on restoration. It's mentioned a couple times, but we felt that it'd be important to include something more formally into the basin plan. And it's an abbreviated version of this resolution itself. There's parts of the resolution that over time will indeed become stale. So we wanted to have something that was sort of timeless and incorporated into the basin plan. What this policy is not is a regulatory program. It's not a new permit itself. Doesn't provide any specific exemption or CEQA streamlining. However, those are all things that are identified in those actions for us to work on in the future. There's such a diversity of different types of restoration projects that we're looking at that it wouldn't really make sense to include some kind of singular process to improve projects that could range from, you know, stream bank stabilization to large wood recruitment to up to larger scale TMDL implementation projects, et cetera. So to start with, the structure, function, and biodiversity of aquatic ecosystems are vulnerable to disruption. We all recognize that. And these are vulnerable to both natural and anthropogenic stressors. They always have been, but more recently, over the last 150 years, there's been an increase in the effects that have been occurring from especially those anthropogenic stressors. As a result, I was speaking with Catherine Carter. She provided me some information from our 303D list. We currently have 137 individual pollutants or impairments on our 303D list for different water bodies. And those come from a wide array of different types of impacts. One we've gone over a number of times before is some of the physical impacts associated with some of the resource extraction that has occurred in our region. We have a lot of sediment impaired water bodies, but that can also be associated with different types of land use activities in the riparian zone, or barriers to anadromous migration of our salmonids is an issue that we've faced up and down our region. The introduction of non-native species like the New Zealand mud snail. We actually just found New Zealand mud snail in the Garcia River 2 years ago, which is a really unfortunate occurrence, but also other types of non-native vegetation, English ivy, or the transition of diverse riparian communities to some of these monoculture stands of like Arundo Donax in the Russian River is a big issue that's been worked on for years and a big struggle for us. But also the waste coming off of some of our major city population areas, some of the chemical pollutants and things. So all of these things together are sort of what we're trying to grapple with, and some of them we have control over, some of them we don't as far as influencing them on restoration. But another understanding we have is that disrupted aquatic ecosystems and impaired beneficial uses are more vulnerable during those extreme stressor events, like larger flood events. This, after looking at this picture again, that doesn't look too much like a flood to me. I can still see a gravel bar, but these days that actually looks like a big event. So, but also catastrophic wildfires we're seeing more frequently, or periods of drought like we've been experiencing over the last couple years, where streams or rivers are either drying up or flowing subsurface, and discontinuous flow is an issue. And then the ongoing and future effects of climate change that we'll have on our region. Now, restoration is an important tool for the protection, enhancement, and recovery of some of our beneficial uses, whether that's stream bank stabilization, like this bioengineering project that Bioengineering and Associates did a couple years ago, or removal of some of these non-natives and replacement with native vegetation. Introduction of in-stream habitat and complexity, trying to reattain some of the natural conditions that were here before some of the disturbance took place, and then removal of some of these migration barriers so that we can have free flowing rivers and spawning and natal grounds. Now, recovery itself, this is kind of our recipe for recovery. It's a combination of pollution control, which is something that we are, you know, regularly doing, but also restoration itself. Here we have that same bioengineering project several years later. But then adaptive management in time. And I include this photo here on the bottom right because, as you know, I've been working out in the Garcia for a number of years, where We've had a lot of success, a lot of cooperation across the watershed. Approximately 80% of the land base is in some way participating in the program to control sediment. We've also got a lot of in-stream, stream-side riparian planting and that large wood augmentation over several miles. But this picture on the right is of the Garcia main stem about river mile 20. And that's a old-growth redwood that still remains rooted into the bank where it's probably been for several hundred years. And this is the deepest part of the channel of the Garcia. It really shows how much material has come down and built up above this area. It's continuing to scour down, but there's a lot of time to go. That tree did not grow in the middle of the river. There's frequently cited obstacles to restoration. We want to support these in any way possible, and a lot of the restoration community cites a number of different issues. Some of them are within our control, and some of them are outside of our control. But some of the dials that we can turn are things such as permitting assistance, public funds. There's a wide array of support organizations from RCDs and NRCS and different consulting groups. And environmental nonprofits that can assist people with doing restoration projects. You've heard of us talk about the watershed stewardship approach, and this restoration policy itself is geared towards trying to help support that. The policy is a recital of existing laws and regulations. Like I said, it doesn't create any new laws or permitting process. And it also recognizes that restoration must be regulated like any other non-point source project. That'd be water quality certifications, either general certifications like the small habitat restoration permit that the state board has developed, or individual 401 certs, waste discharge requirements, waivers, prohibitions, et cetera. And the policy clarifies that how the prohibitions and water quality objectives in our basin plan apply. It clarifies that the action plan for logging, construction, and associated activities does not apply specifically to restoration. It identifies that some projects may cause short-term exceedance of water quality objectives, and that incorporating mitigation measures to minimize those impacts is necessary. And then that required attainment of water quality objectives must be done as soon as possible. Some large-scale restoration may require a larger CEQA analysis and environmental impact report, including all the different components of that. An example in our region of a large-scale project is the Trinity River Restoration Program. We originally issued 5 water quality certifications for that project in 2010. It's designed to improve salmonid habitat over many miles of the Trinity River main stem. Here's some photos of that project underway, some off-channel habitat created, some large wood structures placed in channel, et cetera. And this is an ongoing project. There's a number of potential future restoration actions that we may be looking at down the road, including Elk River sediment removal, restoration of the Laguna de Santa Rosa, increased scale wood loading, whether that be watershed-wide or ownership-wide, and potentially we may be looking at dam removal projects in the future being in front of us to make some decisions on. The policy recites many of the different regional water board efforts to support restoration. I mentioned water quality certifications already. We also have grants, loans, contracts that go to support these projects. Permit development, coordination with different partner agencies, especially as that relates to recovery actions for endangered and threatened salmonids. Programmatic permitting, like the Mendocino County Permit Coordination Program that you all adopted in November of 2013. We've worked with the State Board to keep a low fee structure for restoration projects successfully. I'd say we're looking at the calculator today, and we're able to keep those fees pretty low for restoration, just as a way to support them. We've worked on a number of CEQA development projects to help facilitate the implementation, and there's a number of different collaborations that we've been engaged in. Like I recently spoke with you about Wood for Salmon Working Group. We're part of the Coho Recovery Team for Fish and Wildlife. There's all these different efforts that we've been working on. Water quality credit trading programs is something that we're investing in and participating in development of, as well as support for low impact development projects. The policy also provides directions to staff on how to promote restoration in the future as a recovery tool. The requirement that we must regulate restoration to ensure water quality protection in conformance with all of the applicable state federal laws, and promotion of working continuously with different stakeholders and partner agencies to try and improve the process, try and remove other obstacles, develop new restoration pathways and programs, take action to prepare for climate change effects, and utilize our public funds to support restoration projects in the future. As I mentioned, there's a brief narrative basin plan amendment. It's actually included at the tail end of the resolution itself. We're hoping to incorporate that into Chapter 4, the implementation section under non-point source measures. It's a brief description of the restoration policy, and it relies on the, it provides guidelines for implementation of the restoration policy. But the resolution itself, as I mentioned, includes greater detail than the Basin Plan Amendment. We didn't want to encumber the Basin Plan with a 11, 12-page document. It relies on the, this is supposed to be substitute environmental document, not supplemental, for the temperature policy that was adopted in 2014. And we'll be going through an addendum process to just re-analyze to see if there's any impacts or anything that we did not consider when we went through that substitute environmental document process. The next steps are the public review process for this began on November 17th on Monday, and that's a 45-day public review process. It went out to our LIRIS listserv for basin planning and went to 950 people. We sent it out also to an additional 50 or so, and it was published in three different newspapers. We're accepting public comments as we speak, and we'll be all the way through January 1st with considerations for revision and official response to all those, any comments that we get. And then adoption hearing is scheduled for January 29th, 2015. And that's it in a nutshell. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them or attempt to answer them.
Board members.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Jonathan is always a good job and very thorough. Thank you. A couple of things. You started off your first slide by quoting the Clean Water Act, and I point that out just because I appreciate it, and I can tell you that in dozens of lectures I've made to students both on the Berkeley and the Davis campus, I often start with a slide that talks about the fact that there is no law of the land in America that requires the maintenance of biological diversity, but there is a law of the land that mandates biological integrity of aquatic systems. And I've always found that to be an incredibly powerful statement because it talks about the functionality of these natural systems and what it is they're what kind of ecological services they can provide to humans and non-humans. So I just appreciate the fact that you point that out because I think it's an incredibly powerful statement that resonates in a law where other things, other buzzwords that get used a lot aren't necessarily mandated. And I think that's what a lot of restoration is, trying to get back to the integrity of these aquatic systems. The other comment I would make as it relates to the resolution and discussion of climate change, I didn't hear you use the word, but you know, one of the pushes and one of the primary drivers coming out in restoration ecology papers is these days is trying to build resiliency into these systems so that they can adapt to climatic changes. and edaphic changes. And so I'd ask you, especially like on number 7 on the draft, I'd ask you to read this again and think about where does the word resiliency and fit in, and could we incorporate that? Because that's really why we're trying to do this. We know that there's change on the horizon. We know that there's multiple stressors on these systems out there. If through restoration we can create some wiggle room for some of these organisms. That's an untechnical phraseology for resiliency, but that's really what we're after, is to try and address the existing stresses, reduce those stresses over time, and try and set us up for potential change for new stresses coming down the pipe. But just a side comment, but thank you very much. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you.
Okay. Other board members?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Jonathan, I need a clarification. You had a statement in here on your slide that logging and construction does not apply to restoration, but I would beg to differ. I think that if you look at some of the work that's being done around logging and, in effect, some of our logging permits, the one we just did on the Jordan had a component of restoration in it, and I think we would be remiss with a region with 52% of our region being forested land to not include logging. And is that the intent? I mean, how do you read that, I guess?
No, actually, thank you for that question. It's specific to the action plan for logging, construction, and associated activities that's in the basin plan that incorporates two prohibitions against discharges and controllable discharges in amounts deleterious. There is a recognition, of course, that the logging and the timberland setting in general is a primary candidate for
absolutely
for restoration.
Sure.
And we've been, you know, really focusing on those areas, especially with our most sensitive, and endangered species. Our salmonids are primarily located within those zones. So it's specific just to that action plan, the regulatory element within our basin plan, that does not apply specifically, nor was it intended originally to be designed to regulate restoration itself. That was originally developed to regulate unpermitted actions associated with logging and associated with activities.
Another way to put it was identified as a restraint on restoration programs.
Right.
And so the purpose of this is to remove that as
unrestrain
a restraint.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, I had a great day with you a year or so ago out on the Garcia, and that's
absolutely
all about that. Absolutely. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. I really like many components of this. I look forward to seeing the public comments and some of the partnership comments on this.
Great.
Thank you.
Oftentimes the word rehabilitation is used in conjunction or synonymously with restoration projects. And, you know, often that'll be done when there's a recognition that you can't fully restore a site, but you can rehabilitate a site. And so I'm not trying to find a way to get that in here, but just so the intent, and I know it's clearly what the intent of this resolution is, and I'm 100% for it, but somehow maybe giving a nod to something that labels itself as a rehabilitation project versus a restoration project, one won't be disqualified because it has that name associated with it.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great.
Can you clarify for me what you see as the difference between the two for my education?
Sure. Oftentimes for restoration, and it depends sometimes on the context within which the word is used, but restoration often implies something is being restored back to a original condition or an unregulated or a natural condition. And oftentimes that just can't be attained.
Yeah.
But you can do work to improve ecosystem processes, physical or biological habitats. And to do that, you're rehabilitating.
I gotcha.
Okay.
And the
Thank
policy
you.
Gets close to that. It doesn't specifically use that word. It, I think Samantha.
I'll just direct you to finding 11. It talks about regional board staff oversees other regulated activities, such as land development, offset programs, compensatory mitigation projects, enforcement actions, or supplemental environmental projects. Drop kind of a footnote there that may include restorative actions or requirements. Although these projects can also include actions that are restorative, they differ from other restoration projects in the net effect they may have on the environment. Nevertheless, these types of projects must also be similarly regulated to ensure they're protective of beneficial uses. Somebody changed the language. It used to say regional board should still support these efforts too. To that, but
I think by and large that actually just sends me packing and that takes care of it. So
yeah,
you know, like I said, I know what the intent of this is there, so it's just to make sure that those
somebody you took it out.
It includes, and the intent of it is to include that type and nature of that work.
Sure.
Yeah.
It might be finding seven. I don't have it in front of me, but talks about that, essentially saying that some of these systems are so disturbed already that reattainment of original conditions is just not feasible.
Great.
It doesn't use the word rehabilitation, but we'll look into where that would fit in appropriately.
Perfect. Thank you.
And I want to reaffirm Mr. Gusti's comments. I have seen the staff proposals with the Clean Water Act and without the Port of Cologne Act, or with the Port of Cologne Act and without the Clean Water Act. And so I am glad we've reached a consensus to cite the particular chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the Clean Water Act. I did want to point out, and you have it here, but I treat as equal important on beneficial uses, where you're supposed to designate past beneficial uses as well as present and future probable. And certainly at the time the Port of Cologne Act was passed, a lot of thought was that was talking about salmon. And so I think it's, I just want to make sure it gets equal billing.
That should be in finding one.
Yeah, no, it is in finding one, and I was complimenting you. That's the Port of Cologne, the other, but I wanted to make sure it didn't make it on the PowerPoint, and it's critical. That's all.
So one last point, Mr. Chair, if I could. Yeah. Mr. Noren reminded me of something I wanted to touch base on. So, and you did this, Jonathan, we talk about legacy impacts, and I think for most of us, we think of legacy impacts on timber or coniferous forests, and you know as well as I do that the Russian and the eel and Navarro pass through many different plant communities, many of them which are oak woodlands, which are not subject to Zeeburg-Nedgeley and don't have the same legacy impacts, but are full of legacy impacts from how oak woodlands have been treated in the past, particularly with the rangeland improvement projects of the 1950s and 60s. So, again, somehow recognizing the interconnectedness of the plant communities that our riverine systems cross, wouldn't bother me to see oak woodlands as well as coniferous forests somehow identified, because we know there are so many of those spawning streams, particularly in the Russian, as you get up into the Ukiah Valley, where they are dominated by oak woodlands. And all of the same things that you pointed out in the coniferous zone, impassable streams, degradation of riparian areas, sedimentation, a lot of it's happening up there. So oaks are near and dear to my heart, so I'd just like to make sure that we capture that and not just discard them offhand.
Sure.
Thank you.
I just had one other comment. You had, beginning in 2010, draft planning documents, and you've done a tremendous job, but it shows a little bit you're a newbie, because I'd put that back to 2002 is when the process started. But we really appreciate that we got a product before the board.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I have a comment on something that came to mind as I was reviewing this, and that is the recent interpretive rule that clarifies that conservation activities on active ag operations are exempt from Section 404, mm-hmm. which is great news for conservation and restoration activities in terms of crossing that one regulatory hurdle. But what that also does is if they're not getting 404 coverage, then they're not eligible for 401 coverage and would have to go through an individual WDR process. And so I've heard rumblings of either the state board or regional boards needing to do something to provide maybe a general WDR to supply that coverage for those types of projects so that they don't have to go through a more onerous process. And I understand that that this certainly doesn't create any new permitting mechanisms in this policy, but it may be something that could be referenced in direction to staff or in some sort of goal or even just an acknowledgement of that current issue.
Well, it will come back for the narrative in the basin plan, and I think those kinds of ideas will be explored. So, and if you can send an email to staff, then they can get out to all the board, because I really would dine to read what your comment in detail. So.
Thank you.
Restoration love, it's good.
Thank you.
you want to use an interpretive rule, and it's like, well, I'm already in the 401, man.
The next item.